Maybe I'll start by talking about two things in the book. I'll read a short piece from the book. I thought, since I'm at an anarchist kind of bookstore, is this an anarchist bookstore?
Well, we're still anarchists. We won't even call ourselves that.
It's interesting because I was invited, in 2011, I was invited to give a speech in Greece at an anarchist convention. And when I landed in the airport, I said, "You're anarchist and you're having a convention? I don't get it. You know, I don't think you're not true to the form." But in any case, I had a wonderful time in Greece. And one of the things that happened is that I took a fast boat from Athens out to an island far out in the archipelago, and I met a man named Manolis Glesos. Does anyone know the name Manolis Glesos? He was 90 when I met him, but he was famous throughout, the most famous person in Greece, either reviled or beloved, because when the Nazis were occupying Athens, he and his brother and a friend climbed the Acropolis and tore the Nazi flag off the Acropolis. And he was on the run for the next 9 months, captured, tortured. His brother was killed, actually. And he spent the next 70 years as a full-time activist and organizer. And I adored him. And we spent a day together, a really remarkable day together, walking around his island. He was well known by everybody. We went to his home where he had, among other things, a picture of himself that had been painted by Picasso. He was really quite famous in Europe and quite unknown here. I last read about Manolis a year before he passed, being arrested outside the Greek parliament, because that's who he was. He was that guy who never gave up and a real inspiration to keep going, because you only have so much time on this earth and you might as well walk step by step toward the revolution or the kind of society that could be or should be, but is not yet. But Manolis, as we were walking back to the fast boat, we spent a day together, and we were walking back to the fast boat, and he said to me, "You know, Bill, I think you have the same problem in the U.S. that we have here in Greece, and that is a lack of confidence that we could actually get by without a mayor or a chief of police or a superintendent, that actually we wouldn't know what to do without those anchors in our lives." And he said, "I don't believe it's true, but I do believe we don't have the confidence to think that way." It happened that I went back to Chicago at the time that there was a crucial mayoral race going on, and it pitted our despicable Rahm Emanuel against really 10 other candidates. And the progressive forces kept trying to narrow it down to one opponent, and we never succeeded. And so, you know, Rahm Emanuel was elected. But every meeting, we would go to these popular meetings and trying to kind of agree on a candidate. And every meeting, I would stand up and say, "Why do we need a mayor?" And everybody goes, "Shut the fuck up, Bill. I mean, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? We're going to have a mayor, all right? And so you may not like it, but it's going to happen." So I kind of got over it. But I actually think he made perfect sense. I think that we often find ourselves in situations where we don't have enough models, or we don't have enough experience, or don't have enough confidence. And yet, if you think even of the last year, remarkable year, in which these encampments went up everywhere, and we visited, I don't know, maybe six of them, Columbia, NYU, UChicago, DePaul. And every encampment we stepped into was a model for us of a society we want to live in. There was a library in every one. There was, you know, mutual aid. There was food. It was self-defense in the best sense. But it was a community. It was imperfect. It wasn't a perfect society, but it was the kind of society that we longed for in many ways. It was a little bit of utopia. And of course, the university administrators, as we all know, and I feel particularly bitter about this because I've lived for many years of my adult life in academia. And the university administrators not only could not defend the concept of academic freedom when faced with a group of know-nothings in Congress, they couldn't, in a full-throated way, explain what the right to teach and the right to learn is. They couldn't. But meanwhile, it was going on in their campuses, real learning, real teachable moments. And they couldn't find a way to explain it because they were too busy, I don't know what, counting donations or something. And I think that said a lot. And so instead of embracing the encampments and saying, this is what the university could be. This is what teaching could be and learning. And then embracing it and saying, let's take time off from the grind that we're in and do this full time, university wide. Instead of that, they had them bulldozed and they called the cops and now they've got all kinds of new rules. But I only mention the encampments because they're only the latest example of what we can build together when we put our minds to it, when we try. And I think that gives me strength to go on again and again. In any case, I agree with Glesos, you know, that sometimes what's lacking is our sense, a true sense of our own agency and our own power and our own potential. So I'm going to read just one little piece about after I was done with Glesos and I got on the boat back to Athens and then back to Chicago. Monolus embodied in his commitments and his actions the words of Mikhail Bakunin, the 19th century socialist revolutionary and founder of collective anarchism. Freedom without socialism is privilege and injustice, he said. But socialism without freedom is slavery and brutality. And I think it's a great statement of the kind of dialectic that we have to worry about. We want freedom, but we also want socialism. Freedom without socialism, the way Bakunin says it, is privilege and injustice. My right to drill anywhere in this forest, my right to tear down the trees and build Cop City in the middle of Atlanta. You know, that's freedom without community, without socialism. But we all know what socialism without freedom looks like also. Bakunin's motto, like Monolithus's life, contains multitudes. Anarchism has been persistently and often intentionally misunderstood and misrepresented. Anarchy is chaos and frenzy and tumult, say the haters. Anarchism is a synonym for nihilism. Anarchists promote mobocracy. All of this is a worn-out collection of lazy cliches. None of it true, but the wildly popular cartoon image of the bearded loner with a look of scooped-out desperation in his eyes and a round black bomb sizzling under his heavy overcoat remains. A more hopeful and truer sense of anarchism can be found on display in a large and loving family or a small, sparkling preschool, in a mini-society driven by norms of equality, mutual respect, interdependence, and reciprocity, in which people share resources and care about and for one another. These spaces are not flawless, not perfect, and the people in them are neither angels nor do they aspire to sainthood. They do embody, however, an intuitive sense of fairness worked out face to face. Then they become sources of both freedom and mutual aid for one another. Individuals are understood to be works in progress, questioning, listening, falling down, f***ing up, rising once more, learning and continuously experimenting with and interrogating the world, with distinct capacities and interests and needs, and still members of a large communal space. The prevailing ethic accounts for and corrects all chance accidental disadvantages from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. There it is, imperfect to be sure, deeply human, a little off kilter, and slightly dysfunctional by definition, a wild and in some sense universal model of everyday anarchy and common sense socialism. So that's the short piece I'll read. But I think it's important that we have these models like the encampments and really like a bookstore like this where we can gather and be free and be communal and take care of one another. So I would rather open up for comments and questions. Well, you know, the book evolves out of a podcast that I started with Malik Alim, who passed away 3 years ago in a terrible accident. But Malik was a leader of Black Lives Matter Chicago and a leader of the Let Us Breathe Collective. And he really taught me a lot about what I was trying to do with this podcast. And he and I shaped it together. And that's why the book is dedicated to him. His brother-in-law just left and gave us both a kiss. He's going back to Chicago tonight. But we started this podcast with the idea that we would gather. And I'll just tell you, I told some of you earlier, but my 16-year-old granddaughter said, when we started this podcast, she said, every grown-up man I know has a podcast. And I said, that's true. It's like, they're like weeds coming everywhere. But our podcast, the idea of it was simply that we wanted to get folks together who were freedom fighters and had thought deeply about the question of freedom and ask them not only about their work, but also about what freedom means to them, how they think of it, how they enact it, how they practice it, how they teach it. And that really became the motor of our little podcast, and it became kind of the structure of the book as well. And I think it's important to note that every word in the title, I kind of love the title, that it takes up the whole front of the book. I was sure that it was my working title. I was sure they would make it more catchy, but I like it the way it is. But every word in the title, freedom, abolition, collective liberation, these are all contested, fraught, complicated ideas. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to kind of unpack with active organizers, activists, freedom fighters, what they thought about when they thought about freedom and abolition. And I'll just say briefly that for us, I mean, what we understood early on and what we elaborated and chopped into is that freedom is a concept that everyone in this country endorses. That is, everyone, freedom is practically appliqued on our American minds. There's the Visa Unlimited Freedom credit card, right? And there's the insufferable Ron DeSantis Courage to be Free. And there's the Freedom Caucus. But there's also the Black Freedom Movement. There's Women's Liberation. There's all these things that are contesting. So we dug into that idea that freedom is a contested space and something worth kind of struggling with. And one of the places we went was to the Civil War, because everybody knows that the Civil War was fought for freedom, right? But the interesting thing is, when you dig into it, is yes, it was fought in one concept to free the enslaved African workers. But in another angle of regard, if you look at the documents of the Confederacy, they were fighting for freedom. Freedom against an overreaching authoritarian federal government, freedom to own other human beings, which was tradition, which they'd always done through generations. How can you take that freedom away from me? And you may remember that when they freed the slaves in the District of Columbia, when the slaves were freed there, which was before, you know, the end of the Civil War, Lincoln made a point of paying reparations to the slave owners because they had lost property. Nothing for the workers themselves, but $300 for each person who stayed loyal to the Union and freed the slave. So it's kind of a remarkable reminder that freedom in this country has a very dark and cruel history, as well as very hopeful possibilities. So that's what we were trying to do, is to unpack this. So, and similarly with abolition. You know, there's a whole canon now of abolitionist literature, and a lot of it is here on the shelves. You know, and you can read Angela Davis and Erica Miners and Gina Dent and Miriam Kaba and Kianga Taylor and many, many others. But that canon goes back to Frederick Douglass and beyond. I was interested to note that in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels mentioned communism a handful of times, and they mention abolition 18 times. You know, abolition is an old concept, and there is a growing kind of body of literature and activity. But the thing that we try to do here is, again, popularize the notion that when we're talking about the problem of freedom and being free and naming obstacles to that freedom, what we want to do in terms of our North Star is to say we want to abolish unfreedom. So we want to abolish slavery. And that doesn't seem wild-eyed now. But imagine if we were sitting here in this group, the 25 of us, in 1850, and we wanted to abolish slavery. And we thought, we're going to abolish slavery, and we're going to work on it. And what are we going to do tomorrow? What should we do next week? Well, Let's leaflet at the transportation hub. Let's knock on doors. Let's start a newspaper or a media. Let's get a certain candidate elected. Let's do all those things. But think about it, it's 1850 and we're against slavery, but we're also then against the Constitution, the founders, the law, the Bible, the preacher, our parents, our neighbors. We're against all that, but good for us. We can be brave today. We're all for abolishing slavery. But the other thing we knew in 1850 was slavery was at the heart of our country. It wasn't just an institution in the South. Every bank in the North, every transportation company, every financial institution had a stake in slavery. So we're 20 of us determined in Buffalo that we're going to abolish slavery. And yet, 15 years later, it happened. And that's a remarkable thing to think about it, because I always get irritated when I hear a newscaster or anybody on anywhere say, well, this is an historic moment. They're all historic. I mean, we're living in time, and what we do and don't do actually does matter. So I like the idea of thinking, a little thought experiment, 1850, and we're going to abolish slavery. So that happened in 15 years, but why did it happen? Well, it happened partly because the self-liberating African enslaved people were creating a crisis. And that's true, that was happening. It also happened because there were people willing to organize and be in solidarity with those escaping workers. And not only building the Underground Railroad, but agitating, organizing, convincing, being provocative. And all those things contributed. You know, and then there was, of course, the Civil War, which was the crisis that came and that ended slavery. But you think about, for example, Abraham Lincoln. You know, nobody here has probably read his first inaugural address, because that's the one that's not in the textbooks. Yeah, Tom has, of course, but it's in the it's not in the textbooks. And the reason it's not is that's the one where he genuflects in front of the slaveocracy and says, I have no legal right, and I have no inclination to interrupt your enterprise. That's what he says. Now, nobody wants to remember Lincoln that way, but that's what he said. 4 years later, the second inaugural address is reprinted everywhere. And it could have been and may well have been partially written by Frederick Douglass, because in that one he says, for every drop of blood drawn by the whip, we will draw a drop of blood with the sword. For every hour of unpaid labor, we will make recompense. Holy, he's talking about a concept that today is quite radical. You know, reparations, of course. Reparations for unpaid labor. Reparations for building the wealth of the nation. Reparations for suffering genocide. So Lincoln evolved, and the crisis made him evolve. And I think what's worth remembering about that is that it's never the good intentions of the rulers that bring about change, never. We walk toward change on two legs. One leg is mobilization, organization, and activation of a public, of a mass movement, of masses of people, workers, people in the community. That's one leg. The other leg is real politics, but that's not the leg where most of us should or do spend our time. We should care about it, but we shouldn't obsess about it. We shouldn't foreground it to the point that it obliterates our main responsibility. I often think that the left spends too much time looking at the sites of power we have no access to, the Congress, the Wall Street, Congress, we have some access to it, but mostly it's a medieval auction block where things are bought and sold. But the White House, the Pentagon, Wall Street, we look at them longingly and too little time looking at the sites of power we have absolute access to. The street, the community, the workplace, the house of worship, the school, the classroom. That's where we should be mobilizing. And I'd say this simply to look to history briefly. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, was also a cracker from Texas. And what changed Lyndon Johnson was fire from below. You know, it was Lyndon Johnson asking Martin Luther King for a meeting because there was a revolution brewing at the bottom. That's what we can do, that's what we must do. Or you think of Franklin Roosevelt, passed the most far-reaching social legislation, and he was a patrician from the Hudson Valley. So what changed him? What changed him was fire from below. It's important to remember those things and to note that here we are now, living in history, not in circumstances of our making, but in the circumstances we've been given. And yes, it may be true there was a better time to be an organizer, or a better time to be an activist, but this is our only time. This is it. And so we have a responsibility to our forebears, to Martin Sostra. You know, we have a responsibility to those who fought for freedom. We have a responsibility to ourselves and the future to at least plant the seeds for what others may harvest. So I don't know, again, I'll stop there. But that's kind of a riff on the title, on the idea of freedom. You know, I also didn't mention, but abolition is, I did say, you know, abolition, if you see unfreedom, you want to abolish unfreedom. You want to abolish cruelty. And it's not extreme to say that. But the most telling thing that you learn if you participate in the abolitionist movement is that it's not as pie in the sky as it sometimes sounds. And for me, very importantly, Ruthie Gilmore, the great radical geographer, put it best. She said, abolition isn't about erasure so much as it's about world building. What kind of world do we have to build to make slavery unthinkable? What kind of world do we have to build to make prisons unnecessary? And prisons is an important one because, you know, we have done something in this country in the last maybe decade or more, and that is we've changed the narrative about prisons. We have a counter narrative about mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow. It has not yet translated into policy that, again, unlocks the doors and creates a new society. But again, ask yourself what we would have asked ourselves in 1850. What kind of world do we have to build where prisons are unthinkable, unnecessary? I gave a talk at the University of Pittsburgh many, many years ago, and I had been convinced by Angela Davis that prison abolition was a righteous goal. And so I said in the course of this talk, which it was a talk about the freedom schools in Mississippi, but I threw away a line and I said, we really ought to abolish prisons. And the first question from the audience was, you said that thing about abolishing prisons, you didn't mean literally, right? And no, I said, no, I mean, literally, we should abolish prisons. And he said, are you kidding? Wouldn't we just be a society of mass murderers if we abolished prisons? And of course, that's the thing that we're stuck with. And like every society before us, every society looks at their prisons and thinks they're natural and normal and also regrettable. The punishment is regrettable, but it's necessary. And then I asked these kids at the University of Pittsburgh, can we think together of 1,000 things that we could do that would make prisons unnecessary? And we began, and it was really a great moment for me because somebody said, well, maybe full employment, maybe drug treatment, maybe banning guns. I mean, we could go on, but it's actually pretty easy to think of 1,000 things that we could do practically that would make prisons unnecessary. This kid who'd asked me the first question actually said, well, we really need prisons. And I said, well, for who? And he said, he thought for a minute, he said, well, John Wayne Gacy. That's what everybody does who wants to defend. They always think of the extreme example, the absolutely horrible case. So we can't have parole because look what happened, the single case. So I said, okay, John Wayne Gacy, okay, that's one prison cell. And I'll give you Dick Cheney, who else? You know, instead of starting by saying, you know, a mistake or a crime equals punishment equals the cage, instead of that being the default, what if we start by the other way and say, okay, now we've got 2 prison cells, not 2 million. And then we begin to think from there. But that exercise, that kind of abolitionist thinking has really guided me for a long, long time. And I think it's useful. What kind of society would we need to build that would make prisons unnecessary, police unnecessary, eliminate the Electoral College, then the Supreme Court, then the Senate, then the president. I'll stop there. But, you know, I think that that's the kind of abolitionist thinking that we need to engage in. And we need to embrace abolitionist thinking, not as something that is extreme and extraordinary, but something that is useful as a political framework to think about our work in the here and now. And then the last phrase in the title is collective liberation. Because so much when we think about freedom in this country in particular, we think of the individual because we're swimming in a culture of toxic individualism. And the public has all but disappeared. Parentheses, that's why we need Burning Books and places like Burning Books, where the public can be assembled, where the public can face each other authentically. And I think that when you think about how far we've slipped from, you know, the dialectic of me and we, how much we've slipped into a toxic individualism, so that I become the center of everything. And, you know, I think about it a lot as a teacher, because mostly I am a teacher. And I think one of the complicated things about being a teacher is holding a contradiction in your mind, that every student who comes before me is the one of one, the one and only. There will never be another like this. I must treat this person with not only respect and astonishment, but with awe. This is the only person like this who will ever live. And I have to feel that. And I also have to hold in my mind at the same time, each of us is one of the many, and we are just like everybody else in fundamental ways. We're all born, we're all gonna die, we've all suffered, we're going to suffer. But how do you hold both ideas in your mind, and how do you work it out? I think working it out is less important to me than holding contradiction in mind, because it's a good guide to trying to figure out what to do in the day-to-day. So I'm interested in collective liberation, not what you can do or I can do, but what we can do together. And I often think of my teacher, Maxine Green, who used to say, the imagination, releasing the radical imagination, is essential to social change, but it has to be released collectively. We have to do it as a community, because it took a hell of an imagination to imagine Dachau or the tiger cages. That was an imagination also. But how do we think collectively about a world that could be, and then work in that regard? And of course, you know, I think there's a million great things that we can do to help people to resist cruelty and so on. We spent some time in Arizona with the people who leave water in the desert. I think those are marvelous things. And I think in Chicago, we work with many people who deal with unhoused people and try to, you know, get motels, get tents and so on. But I also think it's important that as we do that kind of work, that we go to the root and we ask ourselves, why in the richest country in the world are people living on the street? And what's standing in the way in Chicago, for example, or in Oakland and likely in Buffalo, between the number of people on the street and the number of vacant spaces? I mean, what's standing in the way? And the short answer, of course, is capitalism and landlords. But I think we have to interrogate why, you know, that's just one example. Interrogate the root causes of the suffering that our fellow residents and citizens go through, and try to hold on to that North Star even as we do good work. Try to hold on to an analysis and study and pay attention. The book, every chapter begins with a poem and then a prompt or a free write, and that's what you're referring to. The poem you're referring to is Imagine the Angels of Bread by Martina Spada. And some of you know the poem. It's been anthologized everywhere, but it's really worth reading. And it begins, this is the year that squatters evict landlords, gazing like admirals from the rail of the roof deck, or levitating hands in praise of steam in the shower. He goes on like that. This is the year that shawled refugees deport judges who stare at the floor in their swollen feet as their files are stamped with their destinations. This is the year the police revolvers stove hot, blister in the fingers of raging cops, and nightsticks splinter in their palms. And it goes on like that. And he keeps kind of reversing. And then the prompt is, yeah, write 10 lines that begin, this is the year. Not as a new, not this is the year I'm gonna smoke less pot, although that might be a good thing. But no, this is the year that something that you can identify as an as something atrocious is gonna be reversed through social policy. And the poem is called Imagine the Angels of Bread, because Espada ends up in the end imagining, arguing actually, that imagination is critical to revolution, that you can't make change if you can't imagine change. And so it really goes on in a beautiful way. So every chapter begins with a poem and then a prompt. And the prompts are things like that, but they're also things like, who are your people? Who claims you and who do you claim? And I did that prompt in one of my prison classes, and one of my students wrote, my people are anyone who's fighting to unlock the cages, anyone, anywhere in the world who's fighting for freedom are my people. And who claims me? The state of Illinois claims me, but I don't claim them, you know, that kind of thing. There are no right answers to the prompts. That's what makes them powerful, is it invites conversation and deep thinking. And I begin each chapter that way because that's how my classes always begin. And because I teach that way, and our podcast does that, we did it in the book. I like Emily Dickinson, who said, imagination lights the slow fuse of possibility. And I kind of like the idea that there's a bomb at the end of that fuse, and you know, you're lighting the fuse of possibility. But that's Emily Dickinson. And there are many ways to think about it, but I think that's all true. It's a uniquely human capacity, and we don't spend enough time nourishing it. And as a teacher, one of the things I often think about is the ways in which all societies are reflected in their schools, or all schools reflect their society. So you would expect in apartheid South Africa to find palaces of learning for privileged white kids and class sizes of 12, and for the African kids, a class size of 50 with a broken roof and no furnace, you know, and that reflects it. And so the question I've always asked myself as a teacher is, where are we? If you think about an authoritarian society, whether it's fascist Italy or Nazi Germany, whatever else they teach obedience and conformity. So in a free society, what do we teach? Even in an aspirationally free society, obedience and conformity would be nowhere near the front. It would be powered by initiative, courage, imagination. And how do we teach freedom if we're not kind of leaning on the arts of liberty like those qualities? So anyway, I spend a lot of time thinking about that, and I think we do ourselves a disservice when we don't find ways to unleash the radical imagination. I think that mass society in general, mass communications, the factory model, all of these things erase the public. They eclipse the public. And I think the public is something that's created through action. So I think that what we saw in the encampments was a public. It was a public that was changing the narrative about Israel-Palestine, but also about the American role in the Middle East and in the world, if you took it seriously. I'll give you one great example of what I think a public is. Some of you might have seen the story Crip Camp, or the documentary Crip Camp. It's one of my favorite documentaries of recent years. And it's a story of a group of kids who had various disabilities and handicaps, who went to a camp in the Adirondacks, or was it the Catskills? Maybe it was the Catskills. And it was a camp for kids with disabilities. And they went there, and it was the 60s, and they began to kind of, they were teenagers and feeling all the teenage things and all the kind of cultural shifts that were going on. And so they began to experiment, smoking pot, experimenting with sex and other things. And then a few years later, several of them found themselves at the University of California at Berkeley. And they began to identify themselves as disabled. There was no community called the disabled, but it was something that they saw that they had in common, whether they were blind or in a wheelchair or had MS or, you know, whatever. They began to say, we are the disabled community. And by naming themselves, they became a public. I'll just tell you a couple things about the story. When they were students at Berkeley, they did civil disobedience, like pouring concrete on curbs at intersections so that you could get a wheelchair up a ramp. That became public policy years later. Wheelchair cuts, curb cuts are normal. And they're not only good for people in wheelchairs, they're good for people pulling shopping carts or people who have babies in strollers. But that was an illegal action that they took as a public that called itself a name, and the name was the disabled community. I think that's an example of what I mean. I think another example that's relatively recent, I mean, I think women became a public at a certain point. I mean, the women were always there, but the idea of being an identifiable group that was making a demand against power, that was something that emerged, and it emerged in kind of an interesting, similar way. That is, women were having consciousness-raising groups, and they were just meetings in living rooms. And the movement toward women's liberation, a lot of, I suppose a lot of scholars would claim that they had a big part to do with it, and maybe they did. But much more important was coming from below, women facing one another saying, oh, you have that problem? I have that problem. You're facing that same situation? So am I. And just meeting in as women was in itself a radical act. And my friend Patty Lather always says, you know, sometimes just us women have to get together. And as soon as we do get together, we not only name an obstacle to our freedom, but we also recognize that we're a zillion different people. We're not all one, but we've created a public. A story about the Weather Underground, let me think. Some of you may not know the Weather Underground was a phenomenon that happened in 1970 to 1981, and we were militant opposition to the Vietnam War. I'll say one thing about how it came to be, my own story. I was first arrested opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965, and it was a pretty militant demonstration. There were 39 of us arrested disrupting the draft board in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we had marched over to the draft board with 300 students picketing, and then we'd gone in and disrupted the draft board and gotten arrested. At that point, there were about 2,000 students at the University of Michigan who wanted us expelled and who wanted to beat us up. And so the idea that somehow it was popular is not true. It was unusual. But between 1965 and 1968, there were about 20% of people against the war in 1965, 20% of Americans. By 1968, over half of the American people were against the war, and overwhelming numbers in the world were opposed to the war. So the war was crippling the U.S. role in the world. It was becoming unpopular. It was creating a political crisis in the United States. In those 3 years, I'd been arrested several times. I just tell you, I found it much easier to be beaten up by the police and arrested than I did, for example, the hardest thing I can remember doing is I was a member of the American Federation of Teachers, and I stood up at a national convention and denounced Hubert Humphrey in front of 1,500 people. And I could feel, who was the vice president at the time, and I could feel my mother standing on my shoulder saying, stop it, Bill, we're polite people. And I was like embarrassed for myself because my upbringing wasn't gonna lead me there. So I organized against the war, I got arrested, I did organizing and activism. But in those 3 years, the Black Freedom Movement came out strongly against the war. So if you read one thing from Martin Luther King, read the April 4th, 1967 speech. He gave that speech many times over a couple of years. But 1 year before he was murdered, he gave a speech at Riverside Church called Beyond Vietnam. And he said, the three great evils in the world, militarism, racism, and materialism, are what we have to fight. And we are on the wrong side of the world revolution. My country is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth, he said. The country was shaken by those things. Muhammad Ali said, I won't fight in the white man's army. No Vietnamese ever called me the N-word. And he faced persecution because of that stand. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, said no black man should go 10,000 miles away to fight for a so-called freedom he doesn't enjoy in Mississippi. And the country shook. Perhaps more important than that, vets came home and told the truth about what they were asked to do there, what they witnessed there, what they did there. And the country really, really was shook up by that. And so in the last day of March 1968, Lyndon Johnson said, "I will not run for president again. I will work to end the war in Vietnam." And we were elated. I was in Ann Arbor, and we just swirled through the streets and landed on the front steps of the president of the university's house. And I had a bullhorn, and he had a bullhorn, and because I was a president of SDS, and he was president of the university. And he said later in his memoir that Bill Ayers and I often disagreed, but he was always articulate and forceful. And what I said that night, my bullhorn was, "F*** you, you mother." And that was articulate for the time. We went home. He said, literally, he said that night, "You've won a great victory. The students have led this, and you've won. You should go home and congratulate yourselves." And he believed it, and I believed it. And 4 days later, Martin Luther King was murdered. And 2 months later, Robert Kennedy was murdered. And 2 months later, Henry Kissinger emerged. And we then knew that the war would expand, and the war would go into Laos, into Cambodia, and that every week that the war dragged on, 6,000 people would be murdered by our government. 6,000 a week with no end in sight. So now we can say, well, it was 10 years, it was awful, and 3 million plus were killed. But you couldn't say that in 1968. It was endless, and it was 6,000 people a week being murdered. And it created a crisis for the country, for democracy, a crisis for the anti-war movement. And the anti-war movement, you know, we split into many, many factions and cycles and so on. And in my own family, one of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing within it, which led somewhat to McGovern. One of my brothers went to the communes. One went to Canada as part of the Great Migration Against War. One went to the factories to organize, you know, working class people in the Midwest. And I did what I did. I don't think any of us were crazy. I don't think any of us were brilliant either. And I don't, most importantly, I don't think any of us actually ended the war. I remember once a writer for The Nation who was a friend of mine said, years later, she said, "I don't think the Weather Underground shortened the war by 5 minutes.
That's not true.
Well, what I said back to her was, "How many minutes did The Nation shorten the war?" Because I think it's a silly claim. I often think of the Premier Zhou Enlai, who was asked by a French journalist in 1948, was the relationship of the French Revolution of the 18th century to the Chinese Revolution of the 20th? And his response was, "It's too soon to tell," which I think is a great response, because we're, as Americans, we're so used to hearing that there's a poll out about what we think, for example, of Israel striking Iran. Okay, we all know what we think immediately. You don't know. We don't know. So I think it's worth being a bit agnostic about that. But we did all go underground, not all of, a group of us did go underground in 1970 after this terrible, terrible explosion at a townhouse in Greenwich Village. And I guess one story I could tell you, you want a story about the Weather Underground, is that we had no intention of doing it like that. But suddenly we were all facing conspiracy indictments and long trials, long years in jail. And so we were building an underground capacity, but we suddenly, a whole group of us at the center of that organization, went underground. And we survived for 11 years. And how did we survive? Well, first of all, we had a huge struggle in which we understood and made a point, led by Bernadine and Jeff Jones and others, that we understood that the most important thing was our political orientation, not our capacity to fight. The understanding that our army against their army, we lose every time. And so that's not the field of battle. That was important. So we wanted to figure out a way to live in a way that was serious about surviving the repression, serious about taking the war to the war makers, but also serious about surviving. And surviving became an important goal. And I'll just say this about that time. I was identified on the street. I was recognized on the street every month for the entire 10 years. somebody recognized me, often came up to me and told me they recognized me. And nobody turned me in. Why not? Well, it's not that they thought we were great or that they thought our politics were great or what we were doing was great. It's just that the anti-war movement was so broad and so deep, and we were so much a part of it, that nobody thought it would be good if I went to prison. You know, they may not have thought that what we were doing was terrific, but they also didn't think that the state deserved that victory either. So we were underground for 11 years. And when we turned ourselves in, the charges that had been leveled against us, mainly federal conspiracy charges, had been dropped, not for some technical reason, but because once the Freedom of Information Act revealed, among other things, that there was a plan on the books in the FBI to kidnap Bernadine's sister's two-year-old son to make Bernadine turn herself in. Once that was revealed, the federal prosecutors felt that they could not get a conviction in front of a jury, and they're probably right. And by the time we turned ourselves in, the country was hoping to leave the Vietnam War behind, and so we were very lucky. It's like what I said earlier about prison abolition. We had a mass movement. We had convinced millions and millions and millions of people about the brutality of the war. And we had, for people like me, I would not have had access to the understandings that I gained about the nature of our country, the nature of capitalism, the nature of empire, the nature of racial capitalism, had it not been for the anti-war movement. So I don't want to downplay what we did do, but it's also a striking reality that we had convinced a supermajority eventually of people to oppose the war, and the war went on, and it went on and on and on. My students are still in prison, even though everyone in Illinois, not everyone, but large numbers of people in Illinois know this atrocity, that the Department of Correction should be called the Department of Cruelty. We were with a friend the other night. When he was sentenced to prison, he was sentenced to 200 to 600 years in prison. That was what the sentencing judge gave him. You think, wait a minute, why? Why did you do that? Well, it's the Department of Cruelty. And that was a cruel thing that he did just to add the cruelty to the atrocity. So I do think that the anti-war movement was critically important. I even think it probably limited the options of the war makers. There were plans on the books to bomb the dikes of North Vietnam, to flood the country. There were plans on the books to drop tactical nuclear weapons. They never did those things. And I think we were part of swaying them away from that. But we all remember the images of the Vietnamese themselves driving the Americans out of their own embassy in Saigon. They ended the war. It could have ended years earlier, could have never started if we'd, and I don't want to be pessimistic or depressed, because I don't feel that way, or despairing. But I think it's also, when I think of world events like that, I think, for example, that it's a failure of the American left that Cuba has been so vulnerable to American power. That's our failure. I don't beat myself up for it, but I think we can do better, and we should do better. I said earlier that one of the hardest things for us is to hold in our minds contradiction. But I think when we identify contradiction, we are more able to not resolve it, because that's too much our tendency, is if we see a contradiction, we want to resolve it. And I don't think we should resolve contradictions. Contradiction is a universal experience of humanity. And I think we should live within them. And if we can identify them, that's a good thing. So early in this book, I identify the contradiction of this being the worst of times that I've ever lived through, and in some ways, the best of times. And how do you hold that in tension? Well, I'll give you one example of that tension. We have a favorite Palestinian restaurant that we go to in Chicago called The Nile. And we've gone there for decades. And when we had a blended family with Mona and Rashid Khalidi, we went there often together, and the old man who ran the place was a huge fan of Rashid's, and we would always have a great evening at the Nile. Well, he's passed it on to his son, but we were in there a couple weeks ago, and the old man was there. And so he came over and sat with us. You know, we commiserated about what's going on in the Middle East. And he said to us, you know, I'm filled with anger and I'm filled with grief because what's going on in my country and what's going on with my people. And he said, but I have to tell you, I'm also so ecstatic that the fact that millions of Americans seem to have awakened like out of nowhere. What happened? He said, why didn't it happen in 67? Or why didn't it happen in 48? Or why didn't it happen, you know, in the first Intifada? He said, I never thought I would live to see millions of Americans understand what Israel actually is and what it actually does. And he said, so I have to temper my grief and my anger with hope. And that's a contradiction, but it's a contradiction he's willing to live with. I think that's really true. I think U.S. imperialism is a monster around the world. I think we are the most violent nation, and we are violent everywhere. I don't think Israel is unique in that sense, Israel, Gaza, but I think it's specific and singular at the same time. And so I think that there was a time when any internationalist worth their salt understood that Vietnam was critical. That didn't mean Panama wasn't critical or Haiti wasn't critical. Those were critical too. But Vietnam was the entryway into understanding the nature of U.S. imperialism. There was a time when South Africa played that role. And today it is Palestine without a doubt. It doesn't mean the Sudan is less important or that Yemen is less important or that all these things are important. Haiti is important. And we should give our energy where we can, but without acknowledging the pre-announced genocide of the Palestinian people. And already, I mean, didn't you already predict it? But now they're literally at the highest levels of the government saying, we're sending settlers into Gaza. You knew that was true a year ago, but here it is. But here's our Palestinian friend saying, I'm hopeful because the American people are finally getting it. And I think that's a huge part of movement building, is changing the narrative. I think the Palestinian diaspora, Students for Justice in Palestine, JVP, with their courage, with their relentlessness, have changed the narrative. You can't talk about it in the same way that you could even 2 years ago. So I think that's noteworthy. And I think throwing our energy there is critical. But at the same time, we're here in Buffalo at the Peace and Justice Studies Association. And last night, Daniel Kisslinger, who's right here, Damon Williams, who just left, and I did a keynote there. And it began with Damon and Daniel showing their film, which is called A Million Experiments. And it's something that gets referenced in my book. Maryam Kaba had this wonderful, wonderful comment that we built on, which was, you know, you don't have to try to find the best thing to do, or the key thing to do, or the only thing to do. Let's not get dogmatic about that. There's so much injustice and so much pain and so much suffering. Do something, create an experiment. And she called for a million experiments toward creating the kind of society, the abolitionist movement, the kind of society that we want to live in. And I think it's in that spirit that I urge my students and people I work with, dive into something. Change the narrative, connect to other somethings, and build the social movement. That's the main thing we have, and we can all do it now. We can all do something now that will lead to in that direction. And let me just end by remembering a comment that I particularly love, which is the great socialist of the 20th century, Rosa Luxemburg, was in prison for refusing to support her own government during World War I. And when she was in prison, there's a set of letters of Rosa Luxemburg that may even be in this store, but they're fantastic. But one letter I particularly loved was a letter that a comrade wrote to her and said, Rosa, the movement's falling apart without your leadership. We can't go on without your wisdom, without your experience. We're dying out here. Please tell us what to do. And Luxemburg wrote back, and the opening line is, first of all, stop whining, which I think is the best advice you could ever give the left. You know, just stop whining. And then she says, my main advice is you should try to be a mensch M-E-N-S-C-H, a Yiddish word. He says, I can't define mensch for you except to say that a mensch is somebody who loves her own life enough to enjoy a bottle of wine and dinner with friends, loves her own life enough to take care of the elders and the kids, but also loves the world enough to put her shoulder on history's wheel when history requires it. Work that out with your comrades. Work that dialectic out. So her advice was be a mensch. And that's my advice too. We should all be a mensch and keep trying. And thank you very much for coming tonight. Thank you.